This podcast is brought to you by PLI, the Practicing Law Institute. PLI is committed to keeping you ever current on the dynamic trends shaping the legal world. Learn more at pli.edu/ftpod.
Welcome to Fast Tracked, Emergent Issues in the Legal Profession, brought to you by the Practicing Law Institute. I'm your host, Jen Leonard, founder of Creative Lawyers. Buckle up as we hit the gas and explore the most dynamic trends shaping the legal world, from generative AI to DE&I and everything in between. I hope you'll join us as we explore the future of law today. On today's episode, we hear from Shalini George, professor at Suffolk University Law School, and Paula Davis, the founder of the Stress and Resilience Institute, about the status of attorney well-being. I hope you enjoy this insightful discussion. I am Jen Leonard, the host of the Fast Tracked podcast for Practicing Law Institute, and it is my extreme pleasure and delight to welcome to the podcast this week Shalini George and Paula Davis to our podcast to talk about attorney well-being. This is a topic that is near and dear to my heart, certainly, and work that I've done in my little corner of the world as well, but I think has become increasingly important over the last few years as we've navigated the pandemic and everything that has happened in the world around us ever since. And so it's a delight to have you both here. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jen.
So we are sitting here recording this podcast and thinking about all the changes happening in the world around us. Of course, our conversations on this show really focus on a rapidly shifting world and the emergent issues that all of that change creates. And so I'm curious about your thoughts about the state of attorney well-being today. And I'm going to start with you, Paula. How would you assess the state of attorney well-being? What are you seeing out in the work that you're doing? What are the statistics showing us, telling us? What's your thought?
I love leading with this question. I have an interesting perspective since I started this work back in 2010. And so when I stopped my law practice and finished my master's in applied positive psychology, I'm like, I'm going to go change and transform the legal profession. And I have all of this, you know, well-being knowledge. And it was sort of, I call it the calm before the calm, in that there were a few, you know, very early adopters of wanting to have these conversations, but really not much at all. And I remember having to spend, I don't know how many iterations of query letters and phone calls with Wisconsin Lawyers editorial board because I wanted to publish an article about lawyer well-being in 2010. And they were so skeptical about it. So from my perspective, really over the last, you know, 11, 12, 13 years, I've seen, I mean, from where we were when we started or when I started then to where we are now, you know, I know there's really a lot to do and a long way to go, and we're going to talk about that, but I feel like we are at least moving the needle somewhat. I mean, to be able to go from that to a virtual program that I did earlier this week with the global head of a huge AmLaw 100 firm talking about law 3.0. And he was talking about, we were talking about positive psychology and self-efficacy and resilience and all of these words that you just never would have heard, you know, back then, certainly not out of the mouths of, you know, very prominent leaders in large law firms. And so it's been a joy for me to see, you know, at least some of the movement that we've made. You know, having said that, obviously there's still a lot of work to do. I just finished working with ALM on a survey at the intersection of psychological safety and burnout for lawyers and legal professionals. And, you know, we may be able to dig into that at some point. But clearly still very much showing, you know, a lot of frustration, not a lot of recognition, a lot of overwhelm, overload, overwork, and what have you. So it's a tough profession. And so we got a lot, you know, we have a lot to do, but we are, I think, making some progress.
I love the way that you are framing the experience that you've had over the last 13 years or so. It definitely mirrors my experience working in law school land, where I started in 2013. And when I suggested some programming on mindfulness, on stress management, we actually, first it was sort of an exercise in persuasion to have people really be on board with it. But also we had to market it to students differently. It was training your brain for academic performance or mindfulness toward achievement type things because you sort of had to hide the vegetables in the mashed potatoes. And so I, like you, am very excited to see how far we've come. And Shalini, with that, you also live in law school land and you are seeing people in the very first days of their formation as lawyers. So they're coming into the profession at a moment that's thankfully very different from the early 2010s or everything that came before it. What's your assessment of the state of attorney well-being where we sit today?
So I agree, first of all, 100% with what both of you have already said. So this is going to be a really fun conversation. But I too started working on these issues probably before most people. I wrote a law review article back in 2012 called Teaching the Smartphone Generation. And I was propelled to write that because I was seeing changes in students and the way that they studied and paid attention and the effects of multitasking and distraction. And so that actually is the avenue through which I came to the broader topic of well-being, was by studying how we learn, how our brains actually take in information, how we translate information into knowledge, and then what are some of the things that can get in the way of that process. And so some of the things that get in the way are obviously not sleeping, not eating well, not exercising, not taking breaks. All of the things that lead to attorney burnout are the same things that we're getting in the way of students being able to really engage 100% and learn as well as they could in the law school environment. So that's how I got sort of interested in the broader topic of well-being. I think my law students today have a lot of really unique challenges because they did finish their undergraduate education during the pandemic. A lot of that put really incredibly extra stress of various types on them. Doing a lot of work on Zoom has its own challenges, I think, from a well-being perspective. So I feel the students who are coming to law school now have really had to bear a lot in the last 5 or 6 years. And that sort of comes together with the challenges that lawyers are also facing. And I see my role in the law school as, if I'm supposed to be preparing students for the practice of law, I think I need to be preparing them to handle the challenges that lawyers are facing from a well-being perspective. So I think, as Paula mentioned, you know, we haven't been talking about this for so long, but the change that I see recently is a lot of data. You know, we have a lot of studies and we have a lot of data that's actually showing us now very specifically the challenges that students and lawyers are having: mental health challenges, addiction challenges, serious mental health issues, and then the issues of burnout and generalized anxiety, et cetera. So my hope is that by starting to address well-being literally from the day students start law school, we might be able to help them learn to build the scaffolding and skills and habits that will serve them in the difficult work that is lawyering.
I wholeheartedly agree. And I wish that I had you as a professor when I was in law school and had access to all of this great research and support. And I know that both of you come to this work not only as professionals who have really research-oriented, rigorous approaches to thinking about this, but also through your own. And Paula, you lead your book talking about your experience as a lawyer and struggling through burnout. Would you be open to sharing a little bit about what that experience was like and why it prompted you to do more research into what was happening?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, the short answer is I was kind of a hot mess toward the end of my the end of my law practice. But the reason why I'm really keen to share my story is I think it just sort of illustrates that when we're talking about burnout in particular, we're not just talking about, I think when we think about the word, we think about people who will so obviously notice, who are so at the end of their rope that, you know, we're noticing all of these things, and there's really a spectrum of burnout. And I feel like I lived the entire spectrum. And so for me, it lasted about a year, but it really started with a lot of like procrastination, a lot of the Sunday scaries. You know, I do my countdown starting at about 3 o'clock on Sunday nights, where I'd be like, oh man, I've got 7 more hours and I have to go to bed and I don't want to. And I tried to stay up because I don't want Monday to come around. And, you know, what I call every curveball being a major crisis. So, you know, I had so much on my plate that even just one simple little request, some basic, you know, request, whether it was from work or my family, just I had a level 12 reaction to it. And I didn't have the language of burnout back then. I didn't really know what it was. I just knew that I was in this swirl of something that I wasn't really able to fix like I could have done before at other times. And so that really progressed over a period of time. I felt what that stigma feels like. There was no way you were going to get me to say anything about it, especially as I sort of scanned my law department. I was in-house at the time, thinking like, well, everyone else looks like they're handling everything just fine. It must just be me. And I'm sort of, you know, I must need to just buck up or, you know, get better at managing my stress or what have you. And then that eventually led, burnout, I call as a gateway process, and that it can kick the door open eventually to other things. So for me, that was anxiety. So the anxiety that I've had to deal with on and off since my teens really just kind of flared up in a huge way. And I was getting panic attacks on a regular basis. I remember needing to leave negotiations. I was in the middle of a negotiation and I could feel one coming on. And luckily the place that I was at had an onsite, you know, health center. And so I just like booked it over to the health center and I ran in there and I'm like, I think I'm dying. Like, what's going on? And then I ended up in the emergency room twice because I had really bad stomach aches being caused by the stress that I was experiencing. And so that whole arc happened over a period of a year. And so I think it's so important for us to be talking about what this is and what this looks like and what it's not, so that we can start to have the right conversation much sooner in the process, so that we're not catching people when they are truly having significant mental health consequences because of their burnout. So, you know, I go into a lot of detail in my book about like how I then figured out that I was going to start my own business, because that was not the first thing that I really thought about. And then it really became important to me to think like, what could I go learn that I could come back to the legal profession or just to any stressful profession and teach people, so that they didn't have to really feel like work had to suffer the way that I, you know, really went through that process. So that was all of the kind of the framing and the thinking behind how I ended up in the Master of Applied Positive Psychology program at Penn.
Well, I'm going to ask you about applied positive psychology in a minute, but I want to just thank you for sharing your story, because I didn't realize until I was reading your book that I have experienced burnout 3 different times in my life. And people have told me, like, I think you're just burnout. And I think I just, yeah, I know I am. And you hear it, but you don't really understand what that means. And you know, it's something more than being tired. Yeah. But reading your book really crystallized for me that it's a whole host of symptoms. And for me, it was the panic attacks as well. And it happened during my 1L year, 2 weeks after we were done finals. So I was in a movie theater, all the stress is removed. I felt totally fine and could not breathe. Had to go to the ER, like you said, thought I was having a heart attack and had panic attacks. And then many years later, started waking up in the middle of the night as a professional with panic attacks.
Yes.
And when I was reading your book, I thought, that's what I was going through. Yeah. It's exactly what I was going through. Yeah. So the personal experiences are so important to share, blended with the data. So thank you for sharing that. And Shalini, I know you've had your own personal experiences that have also contributed to your desire to help other people equip themselves with tools. Would you be willing to share a little bit about your experience?
Definitely. And I'll just say I shared a number of things in my book, which when I was getting some opinions on it, I was sort of cautioned against revealing some of the things that I reveal in the book, because there was a thought that maybe that wasn't professional. And I, you know, I felt very strongly that it's really important to share these stories. And as a law professor, I think it's very easy for students to assume that I must have done really well, and things come easily to me, and I can't really appreciate or understand what students might, you know, the challenges that they might have or burdens that they may have come to law school with. So I'm very happy to talk about things that are out there. And just as a funny aside, when I wrote the preface to my book, I put in a whole bunch of details about everything that was happening in my life. My publisher was like, whoa, okay, let's just take, how about if we generalize a few things and take a couple things out? But the gist of it is that my father, and this is going back, you know, really far in life, but my father had heart problems, and that started when I was in the fourth grade. He had a heart attack when I was in the fourth grade. And I grew up in an environment of, and this is in the 1970s, so things were a little bit different then. He had 2 heart attacks, he had 2 bypass surgeries, and he passed away 21 years ago. So that was a large part of my childhood, was learning about heart disease and our family sort of taking charge of how should we be eating. I saw my father get up and exercise every single day after that. He used to get on a treadmill every morning, you know, regardless of what was going on in his life. And I think a lot of that, more than I realized, became ingrained in me. And I have always, I think, managed my stress and anxiety through scheduling, making sure that I schedule the things that I know are important and beneficial to me. So with that as a backdrop, you know, I have navigated a number of things over the years, but it all sort of culminated in 2019. My mother was diagnosed with lung cancer, and she passed away 3 months after she was diagnosed. That was exactly the same time I separated from my husband of 22 years, and I was due for a sabbatical. So I found myself on a sabbatical in the fall of 2020 during the pandemic. There was no traveling, there was no doing anything except really spending time at home. One of my sons was home doing college from home, and I had decided to write this book. And I found I really needed to dig into what did I really believe and how did I want to write this book. And I really wanted to write it as my voice speaking directly to students, not really from an academic standpoint. You know, I had written some law review articles and scholarly things that you're supposed to do in law school, but I wanted the book to be me talking to students directly. And I realized as I was writing that there were a lot of habits that I have as a person that are really the things that got me through some of those times. I would tell people sometimes all of the things that I had going on simultaneously. And I don't know how many people ask me, you know, how are you getting through this? And my only answer was that I just kept doing all of the things that I had always done. I went to the gym to see my friends. You know, I just clung to those habits of practice that I think I came to understand were so important and so key to who I am as a person, but also were the things that I could fall back on just to get me through day by day. And I put a lot of that angst into the writing of my book and the work that I've been doing on well-being, with the goal of helping students understand that taking care of oneself, like self-care is not self-indulgent, I like to tell them. And for us to stop thinking about self-care as something that is separate from doing well, you know, or, you know, performing well in law school or performing well as a lawyer. Like, we think that we have to be focused on studying and getting A's or writing the best brief or, you know, killing this oral argument, and that self-care is something on the side. Oh yeah, I should go to a yoga class, or, you know, we really minimize self-care. And I've really tried in my work to bring the two concepts together of self-care being really a key component to doing well. And I think I believe in that so much as a person, and I have relied on that myself. And I think that really has been a key part of where I've tried to take this work.
Well, I think it's so important that both of you shared these stories in your books, because in my experience working with law students, it took me a few years, Shalini, to share any of my actual experience with well-being with students, because like you're saying, I felt like I need to be this role model to them, and I need to embody the professional that I want them to become. But the reality is that professional is a human being who has a complex, you know, mental health, physical health, all of the things that going into being a human. And once I started sharing some of those stories with students, I really felt like it helped them, particularly the ones that were struggling in the same way that I was. And I started to see it less as, you know, feeling, Paula, like you said, like a hot mess, because I felt that way at different points and starting to feel like it was a service that I could provide. And I had never thought of it that way. And I really love, Shalini, in your book that you frame well-being as brain health. And I wonder if you could expand on why you frame it in that way for lawyers and law students.
Sure. And it goes back to that same idea of trying to ensure that we don't think of exercise and nutrition and social connection, grit and resiliency. Like, we don't think of those things as being separate from the ability to perform well academically or in our work. So then the interesting thing to me, so like I think I said at the beginning, I started out and my path on this sort of well-being path was all about cognitive health, like, and being concerned with what I thought were my students' weakening cognitive skills. I thought that I was seeing in them less focus and, you know, not really unable to sit for an hour or two and work on one assignment, and I was seeing a lot more mistakes creep into their work. And so, you know, I started all of this research about how we learn and how does the brain process information. And just to really boil it down, all of that is about really thinking about your brain health. So if we are willing to recognize that when you exercise because you want your body to be stronger, well, if you want your brain to perform well, why do we never talk about what it takes to put your brain in a position that it can perform well? And it was so interesting to me when I started doing the research. It was like, oh, all the things that I love to do, you know, go for a walk, go for a run, eat healthy foods, make sure that you have a lot of social connection during the day, even if it's just saying hello to someone else walking their dog, but really, you know, breathing some fresh air, engaging with the world, chatting with people, smiling back at people, you know, having some sort of spiritual connection, and all of these things that. And I'll talk more about students than attorneys in this respect, because what I hear from my students all the time is, oh, Professor George, I have to stay in the library till midnight. And I always want to say, but do you? Like, what are you really accomplishing 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock at midnight or midnight? And really helping them understand that they're not putting their brains in the best position to learn and retain information without thinking about all of those other aspects of taking care of themselves. So I came to the concept of looking at brain health really as a hook, that if I can convince law students and lawyers, like, obviously you care about how your brain performs, well, look at all the things that you can think about, then you want to say that those things are important and you don't have time for them. Okay, well, maybe you don't care about your physical health right now. You think you'll care about it later. It's not going to get easier. Right? It's not going to get easier after you graduate from law school. So the idea is to help them build those habits while they still have a little bit more control over their lives than they will in the working world.
It's fantastic to introduce them to that so early. I always say that lawyers are only hired for one thing, their brain, but we have historically absolutely done a terrible job at actually thinking about how to keep our brain healthy. So we've talked about, and Paula, in your book, as Shalini said, and we just talked about the importance of stories. In your book, you talk about the blend of science and stories to help really make a persuasive case of the importance of well-being. So I'd love to move a little bit from the stories part to the science part and learn a little bit about the work that you've done, Paula, on burnout, because I want to start by asking what causes burnout. And maybe we'll start there. And then I have a follow-up question I want to ask you about the causes. So could you start by describing some of the causes of burnout and what we've talked about, the manifestation of what burnout can look like, but if you want to add any additional detail there as well.
Sure. So I'll talk about a couple of pieces. So there's the three big dimensions of burnout I oftentimes will talk about as a way to help people differentiate the difference between stress and burnout. There's a lot of people ask me that. They wonder, how do I know if I am actually crossing over into something that looks a little bit more like burnout? And so there's three areas for folks to remember. And so the first big dimension of burnout is chronic physical and emotional exhaustion. The word chronic is important because we all have tired days and weeks and things like that. But it is like you can't pull yourself out of it and it just keeps going over a period of time. And I think that's important because to know, because we're starting to, I feel like, overuse the word burnout, and that we use it to describe any instance of stress or tiredness or overwhelm that we feel. And in reality, it's just one component of it. And the second big dimension or component of burnout is chronic cynicism or frustration. And so, you know, I would roll into my office and I'd say hi to everyone. And I would go into my actual office and close the door when I was practicing and think to myself, please don't anyone bother me. Please don't anyone call me. And outwardly, I was very professional with my business clients, but inwardly there was a lot of eye rolling going on. So it's this mentality of like, oh man, can you not figure this out on your own? Like, you're not going to listen to my advice anyway. So why are we even talking about this? Kind of that frustration piece creeping in about people. And then that leads to this third big dimension, which is a sense of inefficacy, or this sort of why bother, who cares kind of mentality. Like, it doesn't matter anyway what I do. It's like, this is just the way of the world and I'm frustrated and this is how it's going to be. And so when you notice those three pieces, and so burnout is all three pieces of those, of the puzzle. It's not just the overwhelm or exhaustion piece. It's all three components. And so that's an important factor to consider to help you think about, all right, am I going in that direction? Or I mean, no, it's just something that looks a little bit more like stress. So that's a big piece of it. And then my favorite idea to talk about with groups, because this is where so little of the burnout direction has gone, is that if we're feeling a sense of burnout and we're noticing it in our schools or, you know, in our workplaces or what have you, we have to take a step back and look at what's really causing it. Like, what are the root causes of it? And the research gives us 6 really big kind of buckets or entryways or pathways to think about the causes. And so the first one is one that I hear across industry, I would say by far has been the biggest driver, and that's unmanageable workload. We have a huge workload problem in our workplaces. The legal profession obviously is no exception to that. But I think it's one of the biggest workplace well-being challenges that we have right now is work sustainability and overload of work and unmanageable work. So that's a big one. The second one is lack of recognition. And this one surprised me at how prominent and prevalent group after group, leader after leader, in law, outside of law, would say, like, we just don't do this, or we don't do it well. And that's everything from not hearing thank you. It's not hearing any sort of positive feedback. I hear from people sometimes that I feel like I'm working at a certain level, but my title doesn't match. Sometimes for people, recognition is, could you invite me to that important meeting? Could you let me do something that's a little bit more prominent facing within the organization so that people can see my expertise and so that I'm, you know, known, you know, within my organization? So that's a big one, much bigger than I thought. The third one is unfairness. And so this could be favoritism. This could be, you know, it's not what you do, it's who you know. This could be there's a lot of closed door meetings and there's a lot of whispers going on and there's the lack of clarity and people aren't telling us, you know, is there a change coming? What's happening? And we're kind of kept in the dark about things. It's also general organizational politics and red tape. And it's frustrating for me. I got to get something done and I've got to fill out 3 forms and talk to 7 people and finally I'll get an answer to something. Lack of community is a big one, particularly as we're seeing that play out in our hybrid work, paired also with 4, which is a lack of autonomy. So that lack of flexibility and control, which those two are in tension right now as organizations try to figure out hybrid work models. And then values disconnect is the other one. So I value certain things about work and want my work to provide me with certain things. And my work environment just values different things. And you see this in the legal profession all the time. You know, the value placed on money and the value placed on prestige and the value placed on, you know, you give up your life if you come to, you know, work at certain places and, it's, you know, your life needs to become solely about your work. And if you value other things or you want a more balanced perspective over your work and life, right away, you're going to be at tension, you know, in certain work environments, and that can cause a lot of stress. So the greater the mismatch in those areas for folks, the more stress that can be produced, which can set people kind of on a path to burnout. So once we start framing it this way, and I always tell groups and leaders in particular to start looking at stress and the causes of burnout through the lens of those 6 items, because you'll at least start having the right conversation. So if somebody isn't being recognized, if somebody doesn't feel a sense of community or belonging, if somebody has an unmanageable workload, the basic self-care strategies that are so important just aren't the right tools to deal with that. If we have an unmanageable workload problem, we have to deal with it with workload-related solutions. And so we at least can get going in the right direction with that conversation, with that framing. And so that's one of the biggest things that I try to get across and try to talk about with folks. So hopefully that gives people a little bit of a different perspective about what burnout looks like, what it is and what it isn't.
It really did for me reading through your research, because I think to the point of this conversation and some of our own experiences, we frequently think of well-being as something that is our responsibility. And, you know, to some extent, it's either are you a mentally tough person or are you a weak person? And the way that you frame these 6 factors, workload, lack of recognition, unfairness, lack of community, lack of autonomy, and values misalignment, almost all of those sound to me like things that are created in your environment through the community that you work with and through leadership, and have very little to do actually with what you come into the equation with. So I think that's really interesting. And then I want to think about those environmental factors and come back to Shalini as well, because you said you started your work with law students in 2012 when you were seeing them begin to be distracted by technology and all of the things around us. Now we're in 2024 and we are surrounded by even, I mean, going back to 2012 seems like innocent days.
Quaint. In terms, yeah.
Right? Yeah, it feels like we had so much luxury to focus, right? And now we have so much volatility around us, so much uncertainty. Paula, you talk about VUCA concepts. And remind me what VUCA stands for, the four letters.
Yeah, it's volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. So that's like work right there.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's life right now, right? And that's a phrase that comes from military training, right?
Yes.
You're in a VUCA environment and you're trying to make decisions. So Shalini, our students now are in an even more VUCA-oriented environment than when we thought they were in a VUCA environment in the early 2010s. So what strategies are you helping your students develop and recommending for developing lawyers that would also work for practicing lawyers to try to get our arms around how to approach our lives and our work in this increasingly volatile environment?
Yeah, what a great question. And thank you, Paula. That was like, it was awesome. I wrote down the whole list. And those are some of the things actually that we talk about. So but I have a bunch of different thoughts, Jen, but I'm going to try and streamline them. So the reason I really focus on the distraction and multitasking issue with students is because that is something actually it affects all of us. It's very hard for people these days to do one thing at a time. Even right now, I'll bet each of us is thinking, I wonder if I got an email or if someone's trying to reach me. I wish I could check, you know, and this that kind of mentality is going on all the time where people are rarely, if ever, these days doing one thing at a time. And what happens when we operate like that is it does overwhelm us. It unnecessarily drains your brain's resources. It does lead to a feeling of being overwhelmed and burnt out because there's this feeling that we're juggling so many things all the time and we can't control it. And what ends up happening from my perspective as a professor and when I see my students is we make mistakes. That's when mistakes happen so easily. And just to bring a little AI into this conversation, it is very scary these days, the things that I sometimes see turned in as a final assignment or even emails or texts that you get because you know, people are finished, I shouldn't say people, co-pilots and the such are finishing our thoughts for us, but it may not be the thought that we intended and we hit send, you know, before we realize. So not slowing down and not kind of paying attention to one thing at a time has really negative consequences for the quality of our work, but also for our well-being. So back to Paula's list, though, and what we can do to help students. Just one example, and I recognize that this is not something that's easily doable for everybody, but I have the luxury at Suffolk of teaching a 1L elective course that I've developed called Professional Identity and Well-Being. And in that class, we talk really specifically about the issues that we're talking about today. So I think part of this, we started at the beginning talking about stigma too. Part of this conversation is acknowledging for law students that these are challenges that you will have. I think for a long time, what happened was you go to law school to learn to think like a lawyer, and then you just go out and you practice, and no one is acknowledging that there's a disconnect of any kind, that maybe you came to law school because you wanted to be a assistant district attorney, or you wanted to do defense work, but then you come to law school and everyone else is chasing an on-campus interview with the big firm and you get caught up in, you know, what are your grades and what's your class rank and what does that mean for you in terms of internships? And one's internal motivations quickly become overwhelmed by the external motivations that you see others have. And so having conversations, explicit conversations with students about what are their values? Why did you come to law school? What is it about you as a person that sought this career out? And what steps are you taking during the course of your law school career that connect with that internal motivation that you have? And so, you know, and explicitly talking about what is the range of lawyer competencies that one needs, not just the great grades, but the interpersonal skills, the trauma informed lens that we can think about, you know, dealing with ourselves and our clients. How will we deal with unfairness, you know, winners and losers, and how do you get a thick skin so that you're not internalizing every motion or conversation that doesn't go your way as being really about you personally? All of these things that just haven't really been talked about enough in law school, I'm trying to bring into this 1L class. And I think just having the conversation is a starting point. Secondly, for students to know that there's somebody in the law school environment who they can talk to about things that maybe they feel like they don't want to talk about in their other courses where they are competing for grades or where they're trying to have a particular classroom persona in front of their professor, having a class like mine, which is a pass, no pass class, and where we talk about some of these issues, students know that I am somebody they can come to, and they do. You know, I hear about a lot of their struggles, and I can help guide them to the proper resources, to let them know that they're not alone, to put them in touch with others who might have similar concerns. So I feel one of the big things that we can do, and the new ABA standards on professional identity formation are sort of encouraging law schools to do more than some law schools may have wanted to do, but to bring those conversations about professional identity and the various challenges that we'll face, internal and external, is how I'm trying, you know, the primary way in which I now am trying to do that in the law school environment.
That's fantastic. And it's the perfect time to do it. And I know in your book, you cite the research that Larry Krieger's done around the decline in subjective well-being during the 1L year. So it's the perfect place to have an intervention like that and to really be supporting students as they're feeling that drift. I certainly felt that drift. I was so naive. And then I got to campus and learned about all these things I should care about that I'd never thought about before. And as you drift further and further from those intrinsic motivators, it starts you down a really bad path, I think, with respect to your well-being. And I want to build upon the point you made around AI and around when we're working urgently and making mistakes. But I want to pivot it into a slightly different direction and come back to Paula and talk about psychological safety and some of the maybe the more positive ways that we can think about making mistakes or being vulnerable or taking risks. I certainly focus on legal innovation, and a lot of innovation really requires psychological safety, which I've learned more, frankly, from other disciplines about, particularly the healthcare industry. They have done a lot of research in the importance of psychological safety. So would you be willing to define psychological safety for us, Paula, and talk a little bit about why it's so important to create an environment of psychological safety to elevate team well-being and performance?
Yes, it's one of my favorite concepts to talk about. And it really is a foundational aspect to good teaming and good lawyering. It's not a nice to have. The research has been pretty crystal clear showing us this is a foundational need to have aspects for teaming well. And really, it's the belief that you can show up to work, to your team, first and foremost, as yourself. So you can be, I always felt like I had to be Paula the lawyer instead of just Paula the person. And so I'd drive to work and I would park my car and I would like leave Paula the person in my car. And then I'd put on like the Paula the lawyer cape, you know, whatever kind of visual I had for who I had to be is like in order to be whatever a good lawyer was in my mind. And so it's the belief that you can show up truly as yourself, that you can respectfully push back, that you can disagree, that you can raise your hand 7 times and say, I have no idea what you're talking about, that you could maybe have an idea about an argument to present or the way that a deal should go, and you haven't maybe thought it through all the way, but you can voice those half partially thought out concepts, and you can do all of that without the fear that you will be somehow singled out, penalized, whispered about after the meeting, or somehow thought less of. And so when you have that mindset, when that belief is cultivated, it's really powerful. And it's also really hard to do because at the essence, you're talking about trust and it's a practice. And so you don't just show up one day and do a little bit and then leave it. It's a very consistent, you know, kind of place where we all have to be in the context of our teams. And, you know, in my book, I talk about different strategies that leaders can do, different strategies for the entire group to kind of focus on. I think Dr. Amy Edmondson, who's really the leading researcher in this and voice in this area, would probably position psychological safety as a little bit more of a leader-based concept. You know, but I always tell leaders, especially legal leaders, you know, saying I don't know, acknowledging the limits of your knowledge, things that we are loath to do as lawyers, is one thing that you, I mean, you don't have to stand up and say, I have no clue what we're doing, but you can say, like, this is the first time I've seen a case unfold this way. What do you all think, team, would be a good approach for this? And we forget that as we continue on in our practices, we've got to have the answers and we got to, you know, be the leading voice and what have you. And admitting those moments of, you know, challenge or struggle can be really powerful because it signals to the rest of the group, okay, we're in this together. I don't have to be perfect. I don't have to show up knowing all of the answers. I can ask questions and we can, you know, kind of figure it out. We can figure it out together. And I love the idea that you brought up too about how do we talk about failure? Because even I in my programs have been like really hesitant a lot to go there with that concept because oftentimes the feeling I get back from like, we can't talk about failure. We're not supposed to like, and then when you dig into it, it's like your work is so complex. It's global. It's fast paced. It's changing all the time. And it's so ambiguous how it's never going to go probably the way that you thought it was going to go. And so maybe failure feels like too strong of a word for you, but I'm sure you've had to pivot multiple times in the work that you do on a day-to-day basis. And so Dr. Edmondson does a really good job about talking about the different kinds of failure. So there's the failure where it's like, I forgot the filing deadline. That shouldn't happen. There are failures that truly, like, we didn't follow the rules. We didn't follow a best practice. Something structurally or procedurally just didn't happen, and that can't happen. She talks about how we really need to think about minimizing or eradicating those types of failures. But if something went the wrong way because you were trying something new or you were thinking about something differently and it caused you to have to pivot, those are learning moments. And so if we can, I think, become a little bit more tolerant about that all failure is not created equal, that I think might help us, I think, wrestle with, you know, some of the innovation conversation with some of the struggle that we might be feeling or sensing or what have you. But that was a very powerful aha moment for me when I started to think in terms of not failure isn't just one thing all the time. It's a little bit different. But yes, so psychological safety, when I feel that belief, that, you know, that sense of trust, then it makes it easier. We can talk about those moments of pivot or those moments of struggle or failure when they're at a level one or two. And I think this is also not just in our nuts and bolts everyday work, but in the well-being conversation also. I don't have to wait until I'm a level nine or a level 10 or having panic attacks and needing to leave my negotiation before I raise my hand and say something's wrong or I'm forced to have to do that. So that sense of trust among teams is just critical.
Love that. And I'm relatively new to the concept of psychological safety. And again, I've learned it from other disciplines who've been doing it for much longer. And I have noticed that lawyers are just getting used to this idea of failure as learning. And to your point, Paula, it is such a complex endeavor to be a lawyer that it seems a little bit silly that we don't acknowledge that becoming a lawyer is about failing and learning along the way. I was part of a presentation that I was facilitating years ago called Mistakes I Made at Work. And we had these very accomplished, high-profile women talking about the mistakes that they'd made at work. And we wanted them to do a failure bio for their intros. And I had to keep sending rewrites because they weren't really failures. They'd say, I applied for these two great jobs and I got them both and I decided to take this one. I said, is that really failure?
Yeah.
That's just making a choice. So I think we're just getting used to this concept. And Shalini, working with new students, and I saw in your book, you cited Judge Krause's great article that she wrote with Jane Chong about the scaffolding and the conversations that we need to have around the idea that this is a complex profession and skill set that you're developing, and we haven't done a great job in the junior years of practice at helping people feel psychological safety. I'll also say, to juxtapose two experiences I had, I used to work with somebody in the legal profession who used to grade everybody after a meeting on how they performed at the meeting. So of course, your takeaway is, I better perform really well in this meeting so that I achieve a higher score.
Well, all you could think about is the grade then, I'm sure.
Totally. Well,
this research will tell you, I mean, as soon as you're in that mindset, you're not going to remember half of what they're talking about. You're going to forget what you're supposed to say.
No, it's terrible. And Amy Edmondson talks about performance cultures versus learning cultures. And in that environment, I was definitely always in performance culture mode. And it leads to a lot of the burnout that you're talking about. And my colleague, John Holloway, with whom I taught a lot of classes at Penn and who was also part of the MAP program, used to talk about how that feeling of being in that constant state of psychological lack of safety means that you are so focused only on survival and only on, you know, this limited window of performance, and you miss so many other opportunities at expanding your ability to do things differently. And then I started working with my colleague over at the School of Design, where they actually do a lot of work around failure and experimentation and giving feedback. And we would laugh in meetings, and like the laughter itself was almost medicinal, right? It felt like you could breathe a little bit. And so I'm curious, I know you both talked about this in your books, what you think the role of joy and laughter and play is in the practice of law, because I don't hear a lot about it. And I sometimes feel like we suffer from a lack of play and joy in our work. Shalini, maybe I'll come to you first and then Paula.
Sure.
I'd love to hear your thoughts.
If it's okay with you, Jen, I wanted to comment on a couple things that Paula said about psychological safety, sort of in the law school environment. So just generally, I think one important thing in the law school environment to help with this idea of psychological safety is just a recognition, an explicit recognition to students that I, as their professor, care about their whole self, not just the brain sitting in the classroom, and to understand that things that happen outside of the classroom or outside of the law school environment directly impact their ability to perform in the law school environment. And so I think conversations about themselves and their persons and things that are happening, and, you know, they write a lot of reflection papers and things just so that I can have that window. I think that's important. And one of the things that I would like to see changed in the law school environment to help with creating a safer and more learning-oriented environment is to change the Socratic method. I really don't think that there's anything to be gained. And it's really getting to that same point you were making, Jen, about being in survival mode and being in panic mode. And, you know, your body is physically then going into the whole process of fight or flight or freeze. And the adrenaline, you know, starts coursing through your body. And your body is going through this whole range of functions that are not designed to help you feel safe, you know, in the moment and to be able to be creative and open your mind and pay attention. And so we're really like working at cross purposes when we do things like have the Socratic method. And there are professors who will say, we have to toughen these kids up. And, you know, I survived this and there's nothing wrong with it, et cetera, et cetera. And I just feel so strongly that's not the correct approach. Now, I don't think everybody should get an A. And I don't think, you know, you should never be asked a question. But the purpose of the questioning and the environment in which those questions are asked and the conversation is had, it can be so different between being in survival mode and being in learning mode. So I just wanted to comment on those two things. And you're going to have to remind me what the question was.
I was asking each of you.
Oh, joy.
Joy. I don't think when most people think of lawyers, they think of joy and laughter and fun, which it's a serious endeavor. It certainly should not be the first thing that comes to mind. But what do you think the role of joy and play is in law?
I mean, I do write about laughter and joy in my book, and I have a couple of corny jokes in there, and I like to think that I crack some jokes in the classroom, and I'm a huge believer and proponent that laughter belongs in every aspect of our lives. It's not only a stress reliever, but it's something that enables you to make connection with other people. And so I think if we look back to the factors that Paula was talking about leading to burnout, there's no joy in any of that. It's when we are joyless and laughterless that we are really like heading down that path. I think that getting to the worst levels. And so again, maybe there's not a lot of humor in the Socratic method. I think there's no reason why we can't laugh as we're learning. And I think everybody benefits from that.
Paula,
yeah. Tremendously. Yes. And so I'll kind of take you through. I've had my own experience, my own journey, sort of thinking about the role of positive emotions and joy at work. Because when I left my law practice and started in my positive psychology studies, I still had a lot of that lawyer cynicism and burnout cynicism. And I'm like, we're going to talk about positive emotions. And I think I even asked in class, like, how am I supposed to like pitch this to a lawyer or lawyers at a law firm? You know, they're going to laugh me out of the room, huh? You know, if I start coming in talking about positive emotions. And then I dug into the science of it. And so Dr. Barbara Fredrickson was one of our professors, and she's really one of the leading researchers and the just powerful science behind positive emotions. And so I kept an open mind and really dug into her work. And when you dig into it, you realize the power and importance that they carry in how we just deal with our day-to-day stuff and stress and everything in work and in life. And she has, her theory is called the Broaden and Build Theory of Positive Emotions. And she digs in very rigorously and talks about when we have enough positive emotions, when we increase our diet of positive emotions in the right way, it broadens our mindset so that we are, to Shalani's point, able to take in more information and we're able to remember details and we're able to pay more attention and focus and all of that. And it builds our resources. So people want to be around other people who have some joy or smile every now and again or what have you. And so it can build our connections with other people as well. And so it's really powerful. So I first, you know, send people to her work because the science that she does around it is so powerful. But then when I transitioned out of Penn and started to do my work with the U.S. Army, it also really struck me there because the soldiers were working on an exercise and I was listening to a couple of them talk about really an armed conflict that they had been part of during one of their deployments. And they were laughing about it. And they were talking about, when they were talking about what made them resilient in those moments, they were focusing so much on humor. And I actually like stopped them. And I was almost a little like off put by their conversation. Like, are you not taking this seriously? Like, why are you laughing about something that's so serious? And they just looked at me and they said, ma'am, if we didn't do that, we wouldn't get out of here. And so that was another aha moment for me to think like, they're not being like unrealistic or making light of something. They're using positive emotions and humor as a way, as a coping mechanism and as a resilience builder to get themselves through significantly stressful moments in time. And so one of the other things that I do now when I'm doing workshops, I ask people, I give people a little quiz and I ask them to think about their last full week of work. The scale of 1 to 5, 1 is lowest, 5 is highest. And the fourth question in my series of questions is, how much joy did you experience in your last week of work? And I tell them that I don't mean joy by like, woo, we had lots of parties and things like that. But it is, do you have any positive emotions associated with your work? Are you having moments where you lost track of time because you were so engrossed in something and you're like, wow, where did those 2 hours go? That there's some levity and some lightness somewhere in your world of work. And I would turn that quiz into a poll for a lot of my virtual programs, you know, especially during the pandemic and coming out of the pandemic. And I would say very comfortably 60 to 70% of the people who responded to that question responded with a 1 or a 2. So the lowest levels. And still, even now when I ask that question and I'll ask people, you know, are y'all kind of like a maybe like 1, 2, how many of you sort of are in that camp, there's a lot of head nods. And I think it maps onto what we're seeing from Gallup and other sources of disengagement, you know, where there's still, we're at about 60% of folks who just don't feel engaged at work. And so that sense of joy and positive emotions is, I think, critical. In fact, as I was, you know, just thinking about this, part of the reason why I closed one of my real estate deals back when I was practicing was because a partner who was with me cracked a joke at just the right moment in a really contentious closing. And thank goodness he did it because he's a partner. He was a partner and could like, you know, take that risk and that chance. And he also just had the right personality to do it. And it just landed perfectly. Mm-hmm. Everyone laughed and we finished the deal that had been going on for hours. We finished in about probably 15 or 20 minutes after he had that joke because it was just everyone lightened up a little bit. And we, you know, finally focused and tackled on the aspects that we had to focus on to finish the deal. So now I'm a big fan. I'm a convert.
I reflect on the leaders I've had in my life as well. And early in my career, I got to work for the mayor of Philadelphia's administration. And I took it for granted because he did exactly what you're saying, Paula. I mean, we were dealing with really serious issues every single day for the citizens of Philadelphia. And he had just a knack for infusing an appropriate and timely sense of levity into the work that we were doing, because otherwise I think it would have just dragged us all down. And it's really hard to keep going to the point of the work that you've done with the military when it's completely joyless and the stakes are really high and there isn't a release really of positive emotions. So I'm going to ask you one more question, Paula, because you mentioned the E word, engagement, and then I'll bring us home and ask you each for your thoughts on what you think the next chapter of well-being will be, because I'm really excited about the progress we've made so far. So you mentioned engagement, and I have heard so much from law firm partners around this word the last few years since COVID. Our firm needs to engage our people because people are leaving or people don't care about their work. And what I thought was really interesting in your book is the idea that engagement and exhaustion and burnout can coexist. So can you talk a little bit about why that is, how they can be so intertwined, and what the quote unquote right solution would be if it's engagement plus something else, and why engagement isn't sufficient?
Yes. So I love this question so much because I think it helps us start to get into some of the nuances of some of these topics. And I think anytime a group, a profession, an organization is new to talking about some of these topics, we want to make them really simple and we want to just put a word around it and plunk it in a little box and then, you know, kind of use some simple strategies and say, woohoo, we did it, which is a really great place to start. But when you start to unravel the complexities and the nuances of a lot of what we're talking about, you see some of these types of intersections emerge. And this was absolutely fascinating to me, but it helped me really start to explain why I was seeing it so much in more so in my one-on-one coaching sessions and more so when I had a chance to talk to a lawyer individually, perhaps, or they would reach out to me with a question about burnout or just wanted why I was sort of stumped or why I felt like they felt puzzled. And it was because if you go back to the three dimensions of burnout that I talk about, there's that chronic exhaustion, that chronic frustration or cynicism leading to that sense of why bother, who cares, that sense of inefficacy, as the research calls it. So what's showing up for a lot of people is that exhaustion and frustration duo. So they're under-resourced, the unmanageable workload, whatever the factors are that are driving those two components, but they haven't gotten to that disengaged point yet. They haven't gotten to that why bother, who cares moment yet. They are still very keenly aware that they've got energy left in the tank or they've got something that they can contribute or that their skills and their talents can lead to help within some organization. And so they're really frustrated about their situation at their current location, their current firm, their current corporate legal department, or what have you. And so I talk to leaders about this because it's a really important intersection to think about, in part because there's a lot of turnover intention with this group. So you can imagine if I'm frustrated and I'm exhausted, but I still feel like I can contribute and I have a sense of confidence about my work and a sense of impact about my work, I'm not getting my needs met, essentially, is how they think this through themselves. I'm under-resourced. And so if this firm or place isn't meeting my needs, maybe the place down the street will. And so I'm going to now pick up that phone call and or talk with a recruiter when they call or start looking and asking my friends for other suggestions because I want to move to a spot where those resources will be built back up and that will alleviate some of the exhaustion and frustration piece. So it's a really important, it's one that I've seen on the rise. It's an intersection that I've seen on the rise. And so I think it's just really important for us to understand that sometimes engagement is talked about as the opposite of burnout, so that if we could just build up engagement, burnout will go away. And I think about engagement more so as like a positive counterpoint to burnout, but it's not fully its opposite. And there's, you know, I could go into tons of detail about the different research strands with that, but I won't, but it exists. And so just thinking about the interplay and the complexities between those concepts, that engagement is certainly part of the puzzle, but it's part of the puzzle. There are other things that we need in order to create an environment where people feel that sense of sustainability and adaptability and inspiration and therefore want to feel or an increased sense of engagement. So engagement is a positive counterpoint to burnout, but there are other things that we need to think about if we want a truly engaged and thriving workforce. The engagement aspect is one piece of it, but there are other components, other things, other skills, other ideas that we need to draw into the conversation if we truly want to get to thriving and well-being and all of these good things we want to see.
That's fantastic. And I would encourage people, again, to read both of your books and to learn a little bit more about the research around engagement, because I found that really interesting. It also struck me that I frequently think this, that lawyers are predisposed to some of the well-being challenges that we have because we're so conscientious, because we're so engaged in our work from day one. And so I think we have a tendency, and physicians are probably similar to this, to get very far down the road to burnout before realizing where we are, because we remain engaged even when we're struggling. So we are getting to the end of our conversation here, and I just want to ask each of you very quickly what you view as the most cutting-edge work being done in attorney well-being, or where you see us headed next now that we've made these strides. Shalini, I'll start with you, and then I'll come to you, Paul, to finish us off.
Oh, this is so, it is very exciting, because I think we're seeing some real innovation in the law school arena around well-being. The thing that excites me the most, Jen, is that I think there's been a lot of programming that's been done in the past that's been run through, say, the Dean of Students Office or sort of volunteer activities that we hadn't always seen students engage or participate in. So, you know, Wellness Wednesday or Fit Friday or Taco Tuesday or, you know, whatever cute term you come up with to try to attract students to activities that we know are good for them, they weren't doing. I think with the new ABA standards and some of the innovation that's happening curricularly in law school, we have a much greater chance of getting the message across to students, because I think, frankly, what we give attention to in the classroom is what students see as valuable and not as an added burden or an extra, like, I can't possibly go to that event because I have so much to do. When you bring it into the classroom, you really highlight its importance to law student and lawyer well-being. And it sends the message that these are skills and ideas that are necessary, a necessary part of the law school learning experience, not just contracts and torts and property. Not that those aren't all super important, but if I think the innovation that I'm seeing curricularly is hopefully sending that message to students in an even greater way than some of the programming that was being offered before. So I'm excited to see. When I started preparing my class, I did some research across the country, and you know, one day there were 30 classes like this, and the next week there were 50. And when I proposed it to my faculty last year, there were 70. And I really hope that's a trend that's continuing, and I'm excited about that. And I will just also add, I sometimes worry that there is a little bit of check-the-box well-being, and I hope that's not the case. I hope that it becomes self-perpetuating, because both faculty and administrators and students can see and feel the value.
100% agree. And Paula, what do you see on the horizon for the attorney well-being movement? What's the next chapter?
Yeah, so I would say, just to capitalize on that too, I do see a lot of check-the-box learning. And so part of what I feel like my mission is to not, we don't necessarily have to completely get away from that, but I think we have to start making the next steps toward having more of a systemic conversation. And so trying to talk about these concepts and well-being and thriving and all of this at the team level. So not just what makes individuals resilient, but how do we create resilient teams? I've had a couple of firms be willing to talk to me about resilience at the organizational level now coming out of the pandemic. What does resilience look like for our entire organization? And particularly really needing to focus this message at the leadership level. Whether, you know, I've had firms define leader at the mid-level associate on up and what have you, but the highest levels possible, really breaking down the business case for them and starting to introduce that and seeing that a lot of the way out of these problems is going to be through educating leaders in certain, we don't have to wildly change our culture, but simple, but very targeted strategic ways to be thinking about the psychology and some of these skills that if you just deployed them in a different way, you could see really large outcomes when it comes to the positive benefit to a practice group or a team or to the organization. And so I think that the education piece, but I also would love to be doing more coaching at the leader level around these topics with lawyers and just really helping them on a one-on-one basis see exactly where their entry points are in their day-to-day to be able to grow and develop these skills and concepts and sort of steer their teams and practice groups into a more positive direction. So for me, that's where I'd love to go with it and where I see. I think it's a really important next step is to get to that level.
Totally agree. And I'm grateful to both of you for leading the charge and for this conversation where we got to reflect at the beginning on how far we've come just in the last decade as a result in large part from each of your leadership in your arenas. And I love this conversation thinking about from the very first days of being a lawyer all the way through lawyer leaders and how we can take all of them into the next chapter. The books are Paula Davis's Beating Burnout at Work and Shalini George's The Law Student's Guide to Doing Well and Being Well. Paula and Shalini, thank you so much for joining us on Fast Track. And kudos to you for your work. And I'm excited for our next conversation to see how much we've progressed.
Thank you so much, Jen.
Thank you. Thanks, Jen.
Thank you for joining us on Fast Track. I hope you enjoyed this fascinating conversation as much as I did. Visit PLI.edu for more insights, education, and resources for navigating this dynamic landscape. And until next time, stay curious and stay adaptable as we work together to chart a course into an exciting future.